Where's the camera? Oh, I got
it. You see it?
No.
You see?
Oh yeah, okay. Hold on, some guitar is trapped.
That's okay. Each other's breathing probably is.
Finally.
It's been a while, and it's been a morning of compromise because I've been trying to move away from the podcast as a tete-a-tete like this, or this is kind of a tete behind tete.
You can see
if
me.
You're seeing the video. Anyway, Patrick's back. We've been in Mammoth for a month now. It's May 1st. Wow.
It's like a reunion episode.
Yeah.
Can you turn my headphone down a little bit?
Yeah, of course. Really, hold on. How's that?
Too far.
We can't have...
Speaking of compromise.
We can't have a podcast without having some reference to the sound. How's that?
That's better. Yeah.
So, yeah, I've been trying to do the podcast more as a bringing back my documentary instincts and shooting in the first person. And I've done that a few times to my great delight and to other people, some people's delight. But Patrick missed and says that I behave differently when I'm behind the camera.
You do. It comes back. Your like interview documentarian side comes back. You inquire more than you spout.
Or offer, yeah.
Or offer, yeah.
And yeah, I guess there's room for both in life. And it is nice, the intimacy of this, like when you have headphones on and you're listening to yourself, you speak differently, you speak more quietly and thoughtfully. Whereas I think there's more action. You're more in an activated state when you're shooting, when you're walking around or you're like, you know, handling the camera. So Patrick thinks most people will be listening to this and not watching it. In fact, I've been remiss in adding several episodes to Spotify. I've only been adding things to my YouTube channel. I've also been taking a break from social media. So I've been off of Instagram and Twitter and focusing on filmmaking. And I think that YouTube is more aligned with that.
But I find it interesting because I think of you as more of a visual artist, but you also, like, this studio that we're in right now is, you're a musician, right? So
I'm a passionate dilettante musician.
Well, but you take more photos than anyone I've ever known by an order of magnitude. You archive things going back decades, right? Like you definitely, I think your memories are cemented by the picture, by the photo. You like calling them up that way.
Yeah.
And I like calling them up in audio snippets. To me, audio is closer to thinking.
But we have a fast internet connection here in Mammoth, which I don't have in the desert. So I've spent the last 10 days downloading my iPhoto, my iCloud photos to a local drive. And there are 285,574 photos, 30,582 videos, totaling about 3 terabytes. And that's only part of my archive. That's not the stuff I've shot on my quote unquote real camera.
That's probably more than like the Library of Alexandria had in terms of
probably data. By far. Probably by orders of magnitude. I remember when I had my first hard drive, first kind of digital photo situation where you had to actually like scan photos. And then I had a hard drive that wasn't backed up, collapse, breakdown. And then I remember telling everyone I had 634 photos on my computer. And that was like this enormous amount of photos. Because if you think about it, like you develop a roll and it was like 28 or 36 photos. And then, you know, you would do that every few months or something. So 600 photos was a lot. Now I might take 600 photos in a couple of days easily. In fact, I think my average, if you take that 285,000 photos, is between 10 and 100 photos a day. over the last 20 years.
See, that's exactly the kind of meandering story which does not end in a question that you would never have asked or rather offered on the video version.
I'm that's consciously perfect. Doing it too now because I don't want you to feel bad for being wrong. No, it's true. Our banter is different. It's true. I acknowledge it. And then you said you like the piano, or you had someone that tell you that they like the piano, right?
The piano is an important part of some people's listening experience.
Yeah, so it's
very pleasant.
I've brought up a whole music setup here, and this has been a sojourn at the end of the Biennale season, which Bombay Beach is where we spend January, February, and March every year. And last year we came up to Mammoth for a month, and it was so great, a mixture of making music, editing the film, and skiing. And so I invited Patrick this year to go in on this house together, and I was really happy when you accepted. And I was hoping we're going to podcast like every day. Instead, this is the last day that you're going to be here, and we're podcasting for the first time, which is a bummer, but better late than never, as the cliche says.
And how long did you rent it for in a completely arbitrarily coincident way?
40 days and 40 nights, to which my friend Mark Rathall, the philosophy professor, said, like, looked concerned.
He did look concerned.
And he's like, that's not a very good, it doesn't bode well, that number,
historically
and religiously.
He's a professor of like religious studies, right?
Or
like
no, it's professor of philosophy at Oxford. But he also is religious and is very well versed in all things to do with religion and biblical texts, especially. So 40 is do you remember what the some of the meanings of 40?
Well, it's weird that in hospitality you it's always, you know, this vacation packages you see in these timeshare things are like, you know, 5 days, 4 nights, Club Med, you know, 7 days, 6 nights. There's always N minus one nights to days. But it's truly the case that this was 40 days and 40 nights because they opened it up a little bit early the night before for us because of how long it takes to get here kindly. So it's a, yeah, of the the coincidences just kind of piled atop themselves to make it 40 days and 40 nights. I don't know. I actually, I knew of the kind of myth of that number, or rather the significance of that number, but I had no idea why, right? I had no idea where it kind of came from. Do you have Mark's text?
I do.
Okay, so I can, let me, I can say, I, like, I did like
it a up right now.
Little bit of research. I think it's interesting. So mostly, during the pandemic, right, the word quarantine came up a lot. Suddenly it became known in common and popular vernacular. And it comes from the 40-day quarantine. Quarantine comes from Italian for 40,
yep.
40 days? How do you say days?
40 giorni.
Giorni. Yeah, so like...
Like a journal.
These ships, like when the Black Plague was ravaging all of Europe, right? They came up with this idea that there was a 40-day, when a ship came into port, a ship from afar came into port, they would make it wait in the harbor for 40 days and 40 nights. And the question is like, okay, is this like, to me, this is interesting because like, is this based on like epidemiology? Is this, you know, statistical? Where did they get this from in the 15th century? And I looked it up and it turns out they got it from widows. So I have this little piece of paper. Earlier in English, the word meant, quote, period of 40 days in which a widow has the right to remain in her dead husband's house. So basically when someone died, the grieving, mourning widow would wait for 40 days before they came out. And it turns out this is based in some old, like 40 appears in the Bible and all these religious texts over and over and over and over as this kind of duration of time that allows for a truly proper transformation. That was the idea. So you can go from in the Black Death sense, you can go from sick to well. In the mourning or grieving sense, you can go from, you know, like true acute grieving to passed on, you know, kind of you're done with the grieving process. And in part it's because they thought that the dead soul would wander the earth for 40 days before ascending either heaven or hell. So it's just kind of like strange and fascinating that this one number ends up kind of influencing like what was in the 15th century modern epidemiology and like, you know, infectious disease care, but also had to kind of came from this text and is about this like larger concept that it takes 40 days to get over something, to get over someone, to in the Torah, it says that it takes an embryo 40 days to become a, like a soul carrying thing. Mm-hmm. And so like this number just keeps appearing over and over, the Noah's Ark, yeah, which was supposed to be like a ritualistic kind of purification and cleansing of the entire planet, was for 40 days. You know,
I was really excited about the 40 days and 40 nights. I thought it sounded awesome. And then Mark looked worried, and I don't think of myself as superstitious, but when you start saying like, this is bad luck or this is bad, like I can't help but have that worry me a little bit. Like my father used to say, it's bad luck to be superstitious. And I think that's right. So I looked it up and I found more optimistic takes on it. So I sent to Mark a thing that I saw that says, in sacred scripture, the number 40 signifies new life, new growth, transformation, a change from one great task to another great task, which is exactly what, you know, was my view of coming here.
Same.
Coming from Bombay Beach Biennale to working on the Dulcinea Dialectic, the new film that I'm doing with Dulcinea. For example, the reign of the great flood, the great deluge, lasted 40 days and 40 nights. And Mark responded, I guess that's the optimistic take on the flood.
Right.
And then I looked it up. I sent him more things, which is 40 also lies between the eighth pair of sexy primes. That's a technical term, 37 and 43. The form of the difference between 2 and 39, and also multiply to 78, which represent the only two points in the set of natural numbers N where the ratio of prime numbers to composite numbers is 1 to 2. But that's a little technical. And then we've got Christianity similarly uses 40 to designate important time periods. Before his temptation, Jesus fasted for 40 days and 40 nights in the Judean desert. 40 days was the period from the resurrection of Jesus to the ascension of Jesus. According to Stephen, Moses' life is divided into three 40-year segments, separated by his growing to adulthood, fleeing from Egypt, and his return to lead the people out. And in modern Christian practice, Lent consists of the 40 days preceding Easter, and we had the 40 days after Easter.
Right.
Post-seeding? Is that a word?
I'll allow it.
In much of Western Christianity, Sundays are excluded from the count. There are 46 days in total of Lent. Anyway, so I sent all of this, and then you asked me to ask him more about the number 40,
yeah,
in which he said then, hold on, give me 3 seconds to pull this up.
Moses was on Mount Sinai for 40 days, apparently, because it takes 40 years to like become a wise person, become a wise man, to learn, and that the closer you are to God, so because he's up on the mountain, it's shortened, it's like accelerated, compressed, so you can only do 40 days. Like 1 day up on the top of the mountain is equivalent to 1 year, so you can do 40 years in 40 days, which I think is kind of funny because the logic is that you're closer to God, but apparently God just like also doesn't like water boiling at the proper temperature. You know, he's got a lot of quirks. He's like, I love when people get out of breath walking up steps. Closer to me they are.
Are my two professor friends who I've wanted to have on the podcast and who have refused is Aaron Bornstein and Mark Rathall. Mark doesn't really believe in the podcasting medium. He thinks it's like meandering conversation, which it is, but I think that's a feature, not a bug. But it's funny because they end up involuntarily in the podcast all the time because we end up talking about them. And so here's Mark, his text to me about the number 40 after, you know, I told him that you wanted to discuss this in a meandering conversation on the podcast. He said, you made me rethink what I thought I knew about the number 40. I'd always taken it as a number signifying trial and suffering. So God makes it rain for 40 days and 40 nights to kill everyone except Noah. The tribes of Israel have to wander in the desert for 40 years because of their rebelliousness. Jesus fasts and is tempted by Satan for 40 days and 40 nights. Going slightly out of bounds from the Bible itself, the Romans destroy Jerusalem about 40 years after Jesus is crucified. But you're right that there's a more optimistic take on 40 that's not necessarily inconsistent with 40 being a number for suffering. 40 also seems to be connected to transitions. Moses spends 40 days and 40 nights on Mount Sinai to receive the commandments from God. When the tribes of Israel are finally ready to enter the promised land, Moses sends spies ahead and they spend 40 days gathering information. After Jesus' resurrection from the dead, he kept appearing to people for 40 days. So maybe the full story is 40 represents a time of trial and transition that might lead to something new and better. That fits the flood and Jesus' temptation too. So that's his text.
So when I hear all of this, I interpret it as, my God, why can't people come up with new stories? Right? Like,
or why do we have to imbue everything that is so obviously insignificant with significance? That's thought that like the rationalist in me has. Like the number 40, is it really any different from 39 or 41 in any meaningful way?
The one of the explanations I read was that there's four elements in the world: earth, fire, air, water, right? Like four basic core things, which apparently they hadn't heard of the periodic table, but sure, four, let's go with four. And that, you know, you multiply it by something and you get 40, probably 10. I think two things. One, I think we're never going to get around the human animist tendency to see meaning in things or animate inanimate objects. That's just a thing we do. But to me, what's interesting is one, these myths pile atop each other. Like the fact that the shipyard dock worker was like, oh, you got to stay for 40 days out in the sea, probably because it was very customary for the grieving widow to stay inside for 40 days, which allowed the soul to purify or whatever, the germs to leave. And so they're just kind of piling on these mythologies and these stories and using them for different means. So you have this number, it has significance, it's supposed to be about ritual cleansing. And then you're like, oh, well, if it works for the soul, why wouldn't it work for the Black Death? Oh, if it works for the Black Death and the soul, why doesn't it also work for the fetus once we discovered that babies grow inside of us? And, you know, is it a coincidence that literally today, I think this is May 1st, literally today, this morning in Florida, the term for abortion ban is 43 days for an embryo becoming a person. So you can no longer get one after 43 days. So is that or is that not based on this centuries old, 40 days, that's approximately how long it takes.
Why do they have three though?
Well, it's easier to think in terms of units of week, probably. These are, you know, these are Floridians. It's not like they're doing a subtraction. So it's like...
No, but weeks wouldn't that be 42? No, sorry. Yeah, 6 times 7 would be 42. 7 times 7 would be 49. There's no 43.
Oh, whoops. Oh, that was the sexy...
There's three types of people in the world. Those that can count and those that can't, as Raymond Smullyan used to say.
I rounded up to the sexy prime. Sorry. I somehow got out of my inability to do a multiplication table with a working memory reference. That's great. One could say, oh, where are these people... Where are people getting this, this... 7-week thing from, or 6-week thing from, is it, or is it not related to this old ass tradition of this numerology superstition, which is probably when I hear that number 40, I think of it as almost like a homeopathic amount of time. So basically homeopathy works because, most people get better most of the time, right? Homeopathy works because every single part of the instruction label for the little strange, tinctures is wait a couple days, or it takes a week, or it takes 2 weeks to kick in, or this kind of like amount of time where a vast majority of ailments will actually resolve themselves naturally. And so in 40 days, the question is how many things actually resolve themselves kind of somewhat naturally? How many transformations actually occur? You know, what is the half-life of memory such that it feels like you're in a different part of your life 40 days, in 40 day units? It's this interesting number that kind of scrubs cause and effect, right? Like if you're truly trying to figure out if something is meaningfully connected with something else, 40 seconds, maybe, if you want to do causality like that, 40 days, like so many things can happen. You're introducing so many contingencies. You know, it just feels like this arbitrary homeopathic number that somehow has lasted centuries. And it's fascinating because even I, in my little, with my skeptical pessimist hat, still found it like really neat that we were here for 40 days and 40 nights. It felt, I wanted to almost like find something to rid myself of, you know, find something within me to transform.
Nice. I think there's, I want to push back on the reductionist anti-meaning, quote unquote, like scientific philosophy, which is what it is, because I think ascribing meaning or even lack of meaning is a philosophical stance, as much as like a scientist might not want to admit that. And I think there's something comforting in a perverse way about saying, you know, there's no meaning to something. So like there was often a dismissive stance by the scientific community about interpreting dreams, right? No, they're actually just meaningless stuff. Your brain is just, you know, doing random. And there's something kind of condescending about saying you there, if any meaning that you're finding there, you're just making it up. And I think, part of me is sympathetic to that, but the other part of me wants to say that, first of all, there's no seeing without interpreting. So there's some domains, though. So we always see as, even when we look at an object and we interpret it as a dresser or a couch or something, and that's like tied to our practices and our culture, and the way we see things as and the way we interpret is always going to be imbued with meaning. And it's not totally up to us to invent. It's not like something that we're just adding on top of it. And sometimes this comes from like a domain being rich with skillfulness, with history, with practice, communal practices. So when you get better at chess, and this example I've brought up 100 times in this podcast, but just real quick to bring it back, like when you get better at chess, you start to interpret the situation in a more rich way. So a beginner will only just see a bunch of wooden pieces, but as you get better, you can say, oh wow, the queen looks impotent in that position. Now, is that a fact about the world? Not really. I mean, it's not like in the atoms that the queen is impotent, nor is it added on opinion, though. It's true. It's like objectively true that the queen is impotent in that position. Like she's unable to like act at her full, you know, strength and potential. So I think when we take these stories that are rich, they're inexhaustible, the amount of meaning that we can find in these stories, and including, I think, a number. A number is rich with historical, what's the word I'm looking for? Like there are just connections that we have between the number and these stories that inform who we are today. So I'd like to say it's a little bit more like the chess than it is like just me inventing an opinion about the number 40. It depends on our rich cultural history, and it's kind of like informed by that. And everything from a couch to a number are necessarily interpreted in this way. Does that make sense?
No, it does. It does. When, first of all, I'm going to shut the door. There's like, one day we do this, there's construction outside.
Yeah, okay, do that.
Or I think they're like,
I'll do a little
making an avalanche happen. Perfect.
My friend Eric Kaplan has a podcast called Terrifying Questions that I'm sometimes co-host of. And they always put these little breaks, and they're kind of like artificially added in because they want to eventually have commercials in there. And that always kind of bugs me a little bit, but they're like, now we're going to take a break. And then they come back, obviously 3 seconds later, and say, well, that was a great break. We didn't really have a break. But now we had a natural break because Patrick could hear things coming from outside. And I tried to compromise to bring Patrick up here instead of shooting in the beautiful conversation pit we have downstairs, because I have the whole audio visual set up in here. But there's also been a dog up here and you're allergic to the dog, so we wanted to open the door. And also I think the cold coming in helps the brain work better. At least that's the case with me.
That was the worst commercial ever. What are you trying to sell? Zyrtec?
Yeah.
Is that what we're selling at the end of our interlude?
Anyway, so I...
Yeah, so chess, right. You were talking about how the chess piece looks different.
That there are domains that are rich for significance, and that I don't think we should just... I think the scientific... the scientistic kind of...
I'm not allowing that one.
Yeah, you are.
No. Post-seed I'll allow, not scientistic.
No, like scientism is the involuntary philosophical stance that the scientist has when he or she claims to know the meaning or lack of meaning of a particular series of events.
Sure. Okay. But when you're the evolution of the perception of the queen as you get better and better at chess is about the causal ability of that queen. The relationship of the queen of that piece within the domain of a game of chess and what she or the piece can or cannot do, right? Like that is very different, I think, than seeing patterns in nature and collapsing them into this kind of interesting number that keeps appearing. Simply because you don't know the rules of the universe. We don't, you know, in the same way that we do know the rules of chess, and as you get better, you become kind of closer in the Mount Sinai sense to the, you know, closer to the peak, the ideal way to play. But, you know, like, not every culture is a base 10 culture. Not every culture, I mean, they do all have 10 fingers, but like, they're not all base 10. And so like, we don't have this number does not appear, but if you took the chess piece, threw it to any single culture, any single person, or the game of chess.
No, but they might have different rules, you know, in different, or they might play different games. They might not play that game. That's so I think in our culture, we play this game of these stories, and therefore these numbers become imbued with these significances that aren't entirely subjective or optional, let's say.
It is fascinating that we don't have like the floor 13 on most of our buildings and elevators and things like that. You know, people, I remember going to Iceland once and being shocked that they believe in these little like gnomes, or I forget what they're, the Holduvok, little spirits, little creatures that kind of imbue rocks and highways and natural features. And it seems so strange to a kind of secular, non-mystical American. And then I came back and realized that I truly hadn't thought about how, you know, we don't have the number 13 in our buildings. And in Iceland, they build around a rock that is thought to be inhabited by one of these Holduvok.
Yeah.
In the same way that we infrastructurally, literally the elevator manufacturer has to take into account the amount of like buttons that are printed with the number 13 because they just aren't used often.
Yeah.
So like, you know, these things certainly exist around us, and people behave differently on Friday the 13th, or if they lived on the 13th floor probably, right? So it does, I'm not saying it has no effect, but the question is, I think it has, I don't know. I mean, I would love to be wrong. I would actually love to be wrong. I would love there to be a lot more meaning in the world than I believe that there kind of is.
I think, well, so if we go to the meaning, the name of this podcast, Being in the World, which comes from a concept of Heidegger and Hubert Dreyfus, my mentor and your professor also at Berkeley, there are different modes of being, which scientists have ignored according to this philosophical view, and that we have not taken it for granted that we know what it is for something to be. And we have taken, according to Heidegger, only one mode of being and privileged it over the others. And so like to be as just an object that we can study the properties of it, the philosophical tradition and the scientific traditions have privileged that mode of being above others. But or even ignored that there are other ways for something to be. So, but the other two modes of being that there are, according to Heidegger, is being as equipment. And so when you have a hammer, for example, it's not just by virtue of an object having certain properties, but you can only have a hammer in a world of in which you have nails and carpenters, and then something will show up as a hammer, not necessarily by virtue of having a certain set of attributes. You might say, oh, well, it has to have a shank and it has to be hard. But then, you know, you can find an exception often to these rules. Wittgenstein did this also, like, you know, what defines a game or what defines, you know, the it's hard to pin down once you realize these other ways of something for something to be. And the third way of being, it was called Dasein, which is a human being, basically. Being there. And what a human does is exactly what we're talking about. A human is a being for whom being is an issue. And through our practices, we take a stance on what it is to be human, which is not set in stone. So through our, you know, being a scientist or being a musician, you engage in certain practices and then certain things show up as significant, show up as equipment, show up as things with properties, and that none of these ways of being can be reduced to the other. Obviously, you are also an object. I could like pick you up and use you as a hammer, but you would not be showing up as a human when you were being an object. Anyway, that's a very fast summary of that. I recommend like digging deeper if that's something that interests you. But human beings have domains in which we have interconnected practices and in which things show up as meaningful. And my only real point I want you to take home with this from this is that you can't just impose that willy-nilly. It emerges from a complex network of practices, of language, of traditions, and it's not just something that you tack on top of the, some sort of objective reality that we're perceiving outside of that interpretation.
Yeah. I think that probably the most accurate base way to describe what it means to be human is like a myth-making machine. I don't know who to describe that to. I'm probably not the first person to say that. I think that's effectively what we're doing. I'm not saying it's inaccurate in some sense. I'm not saying the number is found less commonly in the world. You know, like back to the periodic table idea, there are some elements which appear more frequently in nature, and those are perhaps more interesting for that very reason. And if we're going to be observers of the world, which humans are and have been for, you know, as long as we can record our experiences and pass them down, we have a deep need and tendency to like take what we've learned in this one life that we're given and pass it down and listen to whatever every human before us has learned. I still think humanity is in its infancy, right? We're still babbling. We're still like dropping the pacifier from the table, trying to learn how the world works. And like, okay, so there was this, I love this old story. So I'm obviously a fan of 1982 and 1942's Cat People, two of my favorite movies of all time. And they're both based on like 1912 story from, I think it's called Wild Tales, these old science fiction magazines that used to be kind of like printed periodically. And there's a story called The Bagheera. And both of the Cat People movies are based on this one story. And it's about a hunter-gatherer tribe in Africa. And or maybe Persian, somewhere like far away. And it's a coming of age, ritualistic coming of age story of this like teenage boy. And there's a small tribe of people, and they have a myth, or rather they have a fact, which is that somewhere encircling their territory is a kind of creature that is half cat, half human, half panther, half person. And in order for a boy to become a man in the classic tradition, because you know, each of these hunters, each of these male hunters, you know, for the sake of which or being or Dasein is, they must do this ritual because that's what has been done before. That's what it means to be a man in this culture. That's what it means to be a warrior in this culture, is you do this coming of age ritual. And you have to go hunt and kill one of these half cat, half human creatures and then return. And the entire story is the boy. I'm going to say boy because he still is not a man yet. Coming back to camp, to his culture, having discovered that the myth that he grew up with, that these creatures are out there and exist, is not true. He went out and discovered that these things do not exist, that everything he'd been told was a lie. And his moral dilemma as he's returning to camp is, do I tell the people that, you know, the foundational myth of our culture is a fraud? Or do I single-handedly perpetuate it and fit and slot into just like normal society as it is presented? And he decides not to tell. And so he goes back and says, yeah, I killed one. Yeah, they exist. It's beautiful, right? He perpetuates and continues the myth that is the foundation of the culture. And I find that really fascinating, in part because, like, what it means is that it's quite possible and actually probably true that every single male hunter going through this coming of age ritual before him actually had to do the same thing and had the same moral dilemma and had the same conversations with himself on the way back, which is, what do I do? Do I tell the truth or do I perpetuate this myth? And every single one of them chose to perpetuate the myth. And so, like, I love thinking about the amount of things that I believe about myself, about what it means to be a man in my culture, about what it means to be an adult in my culture, about what it means to be just a good person in my culture. How many of these things are just perpetuated myths from centuries old traditions that I just have accepted and perpetuate unquestioned?
There's the easy part of that story where you can draw this like stark distinction between the reality of what happened and the myth. And so that you have this kind of objective reality versus this like subjective, you know, false telling. But there's a bunch of more subtle things in there in which that's not such an easy contrast. So for example, is it true or false that he came back more of a man than he was when he went out?
Well, that's the thing.
You know what I mean?
The coming of age ritual is not killing the panther, half person. The coming of age ritual becomes, in and of itself, accepting that you are a bearer of tradition and you are a bearer of culture.
Yeah.
And so that's the ritual. That's when, so I do think, I say boy because the story starts where he's questioning this, but I do think by the time he arrives in the village, he's a man because he has accepted that that is what it takes.
Yeah.
And you, right. You were talking about bearers of tradition with jokes, right?
Yeah. Active and passive bearers of folklore. This was a great concept by Alan Dundees, who is a professor of folklore at Berkeley and just really taught a very, very popular and very memorable course for me because I love folklore, not just jokes, but I come from a culture in Italy that's rich with folkloric traditions, one of them being the joke. And we've talked about the fact that the tradition in Italy is to tell the joke. It's almost the conversational equivalent of dessert. So you wouldn't want to start with dessert because it would be hard to follow that with a substantive meal. Just actually, you know, when you eat sugar, it cuts off your appetite. The same thing with a joke. If you started it, it's because there's this easy kind of sweet punchline and structure, like given structure to the way the story is told, it's harder to go into a story that has a less obvious payoff. So it's the tradition, and it's not really spoken about. In fact, I'd never heard anybody talk about this. I've just kind of made the observation coming from the United States and going to Italy all the time that people would tell more subtle stories about things that had happened to them or, you know, things they're thinking about politically or, you know, during the meal. And then as the dessert's coming out, then you could say, oh my God, I heard this great joke. And there was this wonderful beautiful parallel between the substance of the nourishment of the meal and the nourishment of the stories that we heard during the meal and the conversation we had, and the more facile and sweet and fun aspects of the joke that parallel the dessert. So anyway, I'd never given any of this kind of academic significance until I took this course on folklore by Alan Dundees. And unfortunately he's died, but I'm sure his work lives on in ways that you can find. But
you are right now actively bearing, right, his stories and exactly. his ideas.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I love this.
So he said, it's a very simple concept, but it's a deep one, which is that the whole world is divided into only two types of people. Three types of people, those that can count and those that can't. But for real now, there's two types of people in the folklore world. There's passive bearers, who is everyone who hears a joke or a story. And there's no one in the world who is not at least a passive bearer of folklore, because you're confronted with it and all the time. And again, like at the time in the 90s, we didn't have email. We had faxes, and people would send funny stories on fax. And the one of the criteria for a folklore, doesn't have to be oral, it could be written, but there has to be variants. And so if somebody, you know, you would get a funny fax, and then you'd make your own version of it, and folklorists like Alan Dundees would collect different iterations of these folklorics or stories, you know, like myths, and also games that are played can be folklore. Or the palio, which is the horse race in Siena that's been going on since the 1200s, is itself a form of folklore, full of other folkloric traditions within it, like the ways of dress and ways of behaving. Anyway, so everyone who perceives and experiences folklore, which is pretty much everyone on earth, is at least a passive bearer. Then you have active bearers, who are the ones who actually are telling the jokes, for example. So at the end of the meal, somebody might tell a joke, and suddenly you know you have an active bearer of folklore. Now, how is folklore spread? Very easily, when one active bearer meets another. And because every time an active bearer tells a story to a passive bearer, they hit a dead end. But when you meet another active bearer, then that person goes on to another meal and tells the joke that they just heard from the other active bearer, and it spreads. And it's a very beautiful concept.
And we've always had this kind of humorous tension in our friendship, which is that I never laugh at the jokes that you tell, right? I have this categorical distinction between jokes that are about the shared experience, in the moment, and that... Literally, I never thought about this or realized this until you mentioned the active versus passive bearer, which is that
you're an obstinate passive bearer.
No.
Wait, you dig your heels into it.
No. But so I love jokes that cannot be retold. So what the kind of humor that I like, and the kind of humor that I, the wit that I kind of most value, is something that is about a shared experience of people in the room, which literally you could not retell because the conditions could not be reproduced. Mm-hmm. The joke would not work in any other context because it's about something small and nuanced and particular to the exact moment in time that you and the group that you're with are sharing. But now that I realize that when you tell jokes at dinner, it's kind of the ancient version of retweeting. Right? Yeah. you're passing on knowledge. And I love that. Like it totally changed my understanding of what those jokes do. And, you know, in the time, Italians have such, I think, tight traditions, right? As in you think about thousands of years ago and you understand the culture and community, and, you know, there's such a long kind of unbroken history. And jokes, you know, when writing was difficult and not everybody was literate and not everybody could write stuff down or capture or archive in the way that we can now archive every single sense, you know, we can archive sight and sound, we can archive pictures and videos. It even made me rethink your relationship to the amount of photos you take and the amount of videos you take. You are truly an active bearer of this kind of thing, and jokes are just your historical way of passing things on.
And of course the jokes, you could get joke books, for example, and it's very rare for for a joke in a joke book to make you laugh, because it's losing so much of that context. Number one, so often, like someone might say, tell me a joke. And if you tell me, tell me a joke right now, I can't think of one. And I literally know 1,000 jokes, but it has to be triggered by a certain, something that happens, or someone says something about something. Oh my God, it reminds me of this joke. So A, it has to be contextualized by some other aspect of conversation. And B, each joke teller has their own style. And what would be great is one of my favorite things would be like being at a dinner and hearing a new joke, watching my father hear a new joke, and then hear him retell the joke the next day. His bad memory mixed with his own, creativity, mixed with his desire to make things personal always. So he, whenever possible, made the joke about himself. So it always was something that happened to him. The other day I walked into a bar and this man walked in, and like, it was like always, and some people would be driven crazy by this, very literal minded people, when they would come from America, they say, wait a minute, that's not true. and he would say, yes, it is. I swear, he would insist that it was true. And my interpretation of that is that there's a different interpretation of truth, which is the truth of what you get from that joke and the truth of the laughter that you get from it. And obviously in a joke, it's less meaningful and less, it's like, again, it's this lighthearted sweet dessert. But if you take a story, for example, and my father would often take stories that happened to other people and tell them as if they had happened to him, because he knew you would pay more attention and you would get more from the story if you thought that you were hearing something that was true and happened to him. And therefore you got this deeper ecstatic truth, as Herzog calls it, and we've talked about many times on this podcast, versus the accountant's truth.
So on the inside of my mind, about 15 minutes ago, I laid like a snare trap on the ground, and you've been like walking through the forest, not expecting to step on it at any moment. But I think you finally just did. How is 40 not just folklore?
Oh, it is folklore.
So
think folklore is rich with real meaning.
So I want to distinguish between.
It's absolutely folklore.
Jokes come with like cultural, it's compressed cultural wisdom. Often, and it's often like a bunch of like crude stereotypes about one people or culture, but they're, they're based on something, and no matter how incorrect they are, they're based on something, they're based on observation. But like, does that diminish the meaning at all to you?
Well, I would like to distinguish between the joke being the rich with calories, not rich with nutrients, a version of folklore, and I would probably say that myths and stories that our culture has carried for thousands of years and not for like, thousands of hours, and have they have the more nourishing, they're richer in nutrients and truth and depth. And the number 40 probably is somewhere in between those, like in the context of the deeper stories, it has some like real meaning. In the context of it being a coincidentally across these different things alone as a standalone number, maybe less so, things have, they're more or less nourishing, I think, for our quote unquote souls, depending on truth, the richness of it and the depth of it,
So the truth value the doesn't matter so much. I think about when I grew up, I was told this story by my mother. And the story was that Sean Connery, when auditioning for the role of James Bond, was in a room with the like casting actor directors or whatever, and that he auditioned, but he was some Scotsman who had won like Mr. Olympia a few times and wasn't really an actor, or rather hadn't done any major roles. Immediately got rejected, was told no, was told thank you for coming, we're going to go a different direction. And as he was walking out of the casting office, one of the people saw him on the street, having just been rejected, and from behind was watching him just walk down the street and said, "That's how James Bond walks. I want that guy." And that the lesson, as it was told to me, or rather how I had interpreted it as almost like a fable, was like, even when you're dream, you know, the way you respond to rejection is what makes you a man. This was the myth of what it means to be a man in my culture, or rather how my mom was trying to, I think, imbue this lesson, this like go out and hunt the half panther, half man lesson. I've thought about that many, many times throughout my life, right? Like in moments of rejection, which we all have, I've thought about that. And it's like, okay, put your fucking shoulders back. You know, like walk out with pride. Mm-hmm. This happens to everyone, even fucking Sean Connery. And who knows what'll happen from it. But that the most important thing is to respond with resilience and strength to all forms of rejection. Recently, a couple of years ago, my mom revealed to me that she just made that up. That the story was like, she was like, oh yeah, no, I just kind of made that up when I was a kid. She used to do this thing with when fortune cookies.
Wait, the Sean Connery story's made up?
Yeah, the whole story's made up. This thing that I had thought about often.
Amazing.
That I used often mm-hmm. in situations which like I She's would.
Good parent.
Well, so that's the interesting thing, right? Which is like, I mean, falsehoods can be powerful, right? Like the myths and the stories that we use to motivate our behavior can truly be for good, or rather can truly be, they can, like the queen in chess, they can have causal power. They can truly change you in the way that you behave. And the myth of like who you want to be. And so, but it's just, it's such an interesting moment of like, it actually didn't matter that the story wasn't true, but it kind of does. And I feel kind of violated by it, but kind of not. It reminds me of the Bhagita story from that Cat People is based on. What? Yeah.
My dad was a great bearer of not just of jokes, but of cautionary and meaningful tales as well. He would have these, there's a great tradition in Zen of telling these stories, right? That are supposed to, you know, obviously they probably didn't actually happen, but they're stories that they're almost jokes because they have like witty punchlines, but they're not funny punchlines. They're philosophical punchlines. I'll give you an example one, but you have a thought first that you want to, it sounded like you were.
I wanted to ask you whether or not you were told whether or not you were told stories that later turned out to be not true.
Yeah, so many.
Yeah. Okay.
So many. And some are obviously, you know, they're like packaged stories that he would just tell in his way. And some were stories that he would tell about himself. And often I just lived in doubt about whether they were true or not. You know, he would tell these outrageous stories about the orgies he would have with Salvador Dali. And I believe they must be at least very exaggerated until they were corroborated by, you know, Google Books allowed you to search like Dado Ruspoli, Salvador Dali, which if you do, you'll get, let me give a trigger warning of very obscene, outlandish stories that were now corroborated by someone else who might also be exaggerating them, but exaggerating them in very similar ways. So now I believe them a little bit more. But they became myths in a way, right?
I mean, the Decameron is an Italian book, right? Mm-hmm. There's a tradition of those kinds of outlandish events and moments and stories and
these
wild black plague orgies and libertine festivities. So like maybe like the Bhagita, they were building into the generational transfer of those kinds of myths, right? Not saying it didn't happen, but also, or maybe everyone had read the Decameron and they were like, okay, let's live it. Right. It's, so like there's a fascinating way in which we start to live based on the myths. And, you know, the same way that I try to like step into the Sean Connery suit every time I want to walk dejected down a sidewalk, you can step into the Decameron. You can step into the number 40. You can step into all this like theological myth.
So now I'm thinking now all of this has triggered a memory of a Zen story that I think of. I could have told this at the beginning if I had thought of it, but it could have been an appetizer, or now it could be a dessert, or it could have been an interlude. But again, it's like a slightly packaged story that I heard my father tell in his way, and I probably have changed just a little bit. So it's definitely an example of folklore. I would love to find the origin of it, but my father would tell it at the right moments that, and it would help me understand. Interestingly, this is where the wisdom of the young, not the wisdom of the old. And the story was of two monks. One is the student, young student, and one is the old master. And they're walking along the river and they see a young woman crying desperately on the side of the river. And she's saying, somebody help me, please get across the river because my father's on the other side and he's dying and I don't know how to swim. And the monks have taken a vow of chastity and they are never to touch or engage with a beautiful young woman. But the young monk takes pity and he picks up the young woman and he swims across the river and drops her off and comes back. And the two monks continue walking and they also have a vow of silence. So they only speak when absolutely necessary. So they walk in silence for another 4 days. And on the fifth day, the old monk turns to the young monk and chastises him and says, why did you pick up the woman? You know that that's forbidden. And the young monk turns to him and says, why are you still carrying her? I put her down 4 days ago. And I just love that story because the idea that people, for me, like the meaning of it is often you carry around something needlessly. You might be angry with somebody about something they did 5 days ago and you're walking around with it. They don't even remember that they did it. And you're the one carrying the burden of it. And in this case, the young monks did what was necessary and appropriate at that moment to help this poor woman. And the old monk was ruminating on it because it broke the rules for 5 days. And really the old monk is broken the rule even worse because he's taken the he's still carrying this woman around, the thought of her. And that's actually having more of an effect on him than it is on the young man. It's rich with many, many interpretations and meanings.
So as the resident parasite guy, right? So my PhD was in this mind control parasite. And so when you told the story about active versus passive bearers and kind of like some in the passive bearer's story is just, that's where they go to die. Right. Mm-hmm. It reminded me so strongly of the way in which we talk about in the parasite world, the way in which things transmit between hosts. So there's this concept of the definitive host. The definitive host is the host in which the parasite is trying to get into because it can sexually reproduce. The intermediate host is the host that is basically used like a taxi cab to get from one to the other, or like a means of transmission. So for example, the cat parasite that I know, Toxoplasma, the definitive host is the cat. The parasite can only sexually reproduce in the cat. The intermediate host is the mouse, which when infected, like runs up to the cat and then gets eaten and then passes on. Of course, in this analogy, this little parasite is a story, right? Mm-hmm. So there's something also called dead end hosts, which is where the parasite can kind of do nothing. They're not going to get eaten by a cat. They can't sexually reproduce in that host. And so that's a dead end host. So we humans are dead end hosts to this Toxoplasma parasite. We don't get eaten by cats and the parasite just dies and lives with us. So, but this idea of like carrying, don't worry. My story is relevant to your, to this end story.
No.
Because the like this idea of carrying things for too long. Like we humans today, modern human mammals, we contain within us legacies of so many battles throughout like evolutionary history. So we have in our genomes a legacy of viruses that have been infecting mammals and life for millions of years that find their, that like basically literally insert themselves into our genomes and then just get passed on. And we think about viruses as mostly a bad thing because those are the ones we hear about. But literally, these moments where viruses came in and incorporated themselves into our being allowed and enabled things like us to pass neurotransmitters back and forth between neurons, which gave rise to all of thought. They allowed us to take birthing and make it internal and make a placenta, which can connect to the circulatory system of the mother and allow us to give birth like from the inside instead of laying eggs on the outside. This was a viral ability, which we took, put inside our genome, shoved it in, or rather was shoved in, and then we decided to use it for good, right? And it allowed us. And so I think there's something really fascinating about like these burdens we carry, that's burdens we carry for too long. Or these stories that we carry with us in our, you know, in our genomes, in our minds, in our culture, in our traditions, that like truly allow us to transform, that truly allow us to be a different kind of creature and a different kind of being, and like probably for the better.
It's so funny because the Dan Dennett, who just recently passed away, and we should mention, rest in peace, and all the other kind of new atheists, the Dawkins and Sam Harris, and they, one of their favorite ways of looking at religion is as this kind of parasitic, infectious idea that is passed along for its own sake, but to the detriment of humanity. Right. That was like a metaphor that I've often heard them talk about. And it's funny because seeing it that way is so poetic and interpretive. And, you know, obviously it's not a scientific fact that religion is a parasite. It's a metaphor, and it's a useful one if you want to have this negative valence to it. But it just occurred to me that we should maybe there's a positive valence of the same metaphor of saying, yes, these are stories that are passed on from person to person. They have a kind of life of their own, like the parasite, and it passes on. But why see it as a disease? Why not see it as a positive bacterium that's actually helping us out? You know, like, and we carry these stories with us. I remember Sean Kelly, who was one of Bert's students, who's a professor at Harvard now, he was talking to a Chinese person about how they have to study and memorize these poems, these traditional folkloric poems that go back thousands of years, and they memorize pages and pages. And he asked, you know, like a good rationalist, what's the point in memorizing these things when you could just look it up and in a book or on the internet? And the person said, we Chinese have these stories passively. They're living inside us, mm-hmm. like the parasite. And when all of a sudden you are going through a very difficult, challenging moment in your life, you lose somebody, somebody dies, the husband or wife or parent or child, or you go through a divorce or whatever it is, suddenly a part of that poem, the relevant part of that poem, will just come into your mind.
Yeah.
And it will give you the wisdom you need for that moment.
Yeah.
And that's how I think of these stories. Again, the joke is the funny, sugary version of that. Is I don't think you like remember a joke to like help you through a difficult time, but I do. It does happen to me sometimes that something will remind me of a joke and it'll just make me laugh to myself. And sometimes Dulcinea will be like, why are you laughing? And I'll just be thinking of a joke that that just resides somewhere there. Sometimes it'll be a joke that I literally haven't thought of in 30 years, but something will trigger the memory because it'll, you know, I'll hear something about a frog or something. And then there was this joke my grandfather told me about a frog, and it'll remind me of that lunch that we had that was so great, and his style of telling jokes, you know.
You also eat ice cream anytime it's in front of you. So you're a dessert forward.
A gourmand. And then the other thing I wanted to tell is that, you know, I've coming up is the greatest and most unexpected honor of my life. I've been invited to give the graduation speech to the philosophy grads at Berkeley, the commencement speech in 10 days at the end of the 40 days. And I, as I've been writing it, remembered this story of Bertrand Russell's that I had. I don't remember where I heard it, but I'm convinced that I heard it from him. Either I read it of his, or I heard it, you know, in a recorded interview. But the story is that at the end of his life, he was, you know, 97, and he was going over the trajectory of his career. And he said, you know, when I was young, my brain worked really well. And I did mathematics. And then after 10 years of doing mathematics, you know, as you get older, your brain starts working less well. And so I became a little too stupid for mathematics. Most mathematicians do their best work in their 20s. So I got into philosophy. And then he said, I did philosophy for 40 years, and I became then a little senile and too stupid for philosophy. So I got into politics. And I was telling the story to an old Italian woman who was in the fashion world. And she turned to me without missing a beat and said, let me guess, after that fashion. And I just love this story because I love that I got to add my own personal experience onto it. I love the Italian woman. The whole vision of it is wonderful. So I want to include it in my speech. Now, my two scientist friends were here, and I told them that I don't remember and I can't find any evidence of Bertrand Russell ever saying this. This, my Italian self, my non-scientist self, gives zero fucks about the fact whether this story was actually told or not. But Patrick and Aaron, being scientists and being Americans, said, no, Tao, you should really find the source of the story. And I looked for a while, but I don't want to look too hard, because if it was definitively proven to me somehow, it's hard to prove a negative, but if it was somehow proven to me that this didn't happen, and for some reason I had to like qualify the story and say some probably apocryphal or distance myself from it in some way, I think that would take away from the story's power. And I really don't want to have to do that. Anyway, but Patrick, you have volunteered to help search for it a little bit. And Aaron did suggest like looking in the, you know, contacting the Bertrand Russell, what do they call the archive? Society, the Bertrand Russell Society.
In scientism, all you can do is prove a negative. So I think we can do that, but yes, I will.
What do you mean? How could you prove that he never told the story? All you can prove is that you can't find it.
No, that you try to disprove things. I mean, all of the scientific method is not the attempt to prove. It's the attempt to disprove the null, that like a hypothesis that is the narrow version.
I'm just saying it's hard to prove that he didn't tell the story because you can't find it.
Colloquially, like, I know what you mean.
It's like Louis C.K. said all we can be is agnostic. He said the really hardcore atheist, back to bringing back Dawkins and all these people, he's like, he joked saying, how do you know there's no God? Well, I can't, we haven't seen him. And it's like, you know, human beings can see a couple of miles if there's no buildings in the way. So all you can say is we haven't seen it.
Well, we're at the top of a mountain. We're hypothetically a little bit closer. So the ecstatic truth is fine to you. It's fine to me, right? Like I love the Werner Herzogian approach, but it's, you know, I do find it antithetical to a lot of what I've kind of committed my career to. You know, fact-checking essays that I write is the most onerous task of anything I've ever done in life, where the attempt is to be as close to the truth as factually correct as possible. And so it's funny that like, but in the way that I often tell stories, just personally, anecdotally, you know, conversationally around dinner tables, you know, I kind of flirt with the Herzog ecstatic truth because I know I also have this domain in my life, which is the, you know, neuroscientist and journalist side, where I have to like put on the different hat and be so factually correct that it's burdensome. Because
and that's one, a cultural fact about our culture and the culture, the world of science and the American culture, privilege a certain type of truth and say you should spend time thinking about that. Whereas in Italy, for example, doctors are told that if someone has no hope of living, you don't tell the patient that. Right, like there's no point in it, right? So there's a different relationship to the quote unquote truth, and I think acknowledging that that's culturally contingent is important.
Well, so there's this interesting conversation I was having.
Because it's true.
Well, so my last New Yorker piece about AI, I was having a conversation with the fact checker days before it came out. And we were fact checking something about, you know, someone's intention 100 years ago as they were working for Disney Animation in the 1930s. And we were just having this long conversation back and forth about like, you know, how do we describe, how do we put into words this moment? How do we put into words the intention of a dead person who we can't ask? And at some point, you know, I was just fatigued and I wanted to just like put something down. And the fact checker's response was like, no, people look to us. People will read this in the future. He was taking on the umbrage, the burden of being the active bearer of truth. Mm-hmm. He's like, look, when something gets into this magazine, you know, people in the future look to us and we become the standard bearer of truth. And so there's this burden to actually like continue and pass on. And I hadn't thought about it as this active bearer burden.
There's a great clip of a very young and arrogant Bob Dylan in a press conference. And there's a reporter from Time magazine who's interviewing him. And at the time, I guess the reporters would go out and then they would send in their notes and then someone else would write the piece at a desk somewhere else completely. And Dylan is calling out this reporter for being ignorant, for not understanding anything that he's about. And he's like, you don't know anything about me. I know a million things more about you than you'll ever know about me. You're going to say that I'm a folk singer when I'm not a folk singer. And then he says, you work for Time magazine. They have too much at stake to ever print the truth. Mm-hmm. And the guy's like, well, what do you mean the truth? And he's like, you know, I read Time magazine on the plane because it's small, it's packaged. I can like consume it, but I don't look for the truth in there. And then the reporter says, well, what do you mean by the truth? And he's like, do you know the truth? Like two pictures juxtaposed against each other, like Mr. Rockefeller going to work on one side and a tramp vomiting on the other. And it's a really powerful moment because, again, like what is that image that he creates of like the inequality of our culture, that the type of truth that he's trying to get at in his music, calls out Time magazine that says a bunch of like facts that Bob Dylan played at a folk concert. And he says, you know, like, A, I'm not even a folk musician. You'll say I'm a folk musician, he says, but I'm not. Because he wrote songs. He didn't do folkloric songs, which are passed on from generation to generation. He wrote his own songs. But it entered the folklore that Bob Dylan is a folk singer because of, you know, a facile interpretation and a wrong interpretation of what folk singing is. Mm. So
that's nice.
Time magazine was going to print that Bob Dylan did a concert, that he was arrogant probably in his press conference, and it would have said certain things. But Bob Dylan says, you are never going to print something deeply true in the magazine. You've got too much to lose, you know, in doing that.
That's great. I love that. So we have, I just kept imagining like, as you were telling that story, strands of DNA floating, and I'll tell you why. So like what it's the difference between the truth. So the way that we think about the transmission of biological information, right, over through generations is, oh, there's this little bits of DNA and that contains information. And then it gets like repackaged and put into a new person in mixed variably, as you said about folklore, right? It has to mm-hmm. change. So We have woolly mammoth DNA. We found woolly mammoth DNA, and people are trying to bring back a woolly mammoth, right? So in this analogy, you know, there's some story that we've uncovered and we're trying to bring back the story, right? We're trying to bring back the original version of it. But if you know, there's all kinds of salacious headlines about how we're bringing back the dodo and the woolly mammoth, et cetera, et cetera. But we will never, ever, ever, ever be able to do that. Actually, truthfully, in the Bob Dylan sense of truth. The reason is we do not have a woolly mammoth womb in which to grow the thing. So we can take the DNA and we can turn it into some sort of embryo. But today, in order to kind of resurrect that creature, we would have to put it into the kind of womb of a female elephant. And that elephant may or may not be able to grow something. And it probably could give birth to something that had woolly mammoth DNA in it. But fundamentally, the context has changed. Because the elephant womb is going to shape it a little bit.
Wait, are you really going to bring up the elephant in the womb? Sorry. Go on.
Do mics pick up applause? Yes. If I could stand, I'd give you a standing ovation.
Go on.
Don't we just end it there? Yeah.